Board Game Bros. Hello, listeners.
Hi, everybody.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. And it's another weekly scheduled episode where we talk about one particular board game. We're going to talk about how it's played. We're going to talk about some of the strategies in the game. And then we're going to talk about how it was designed. So, right. Matthew, what game are we talking
about? How it's made.
How it's played and how it's made is a very pithy way of saying it, yes. Matthew, what game are we talking about today?
We are talking about Heaven and Ale, designed by Michael Kiesling and Andrea Schmidt, and published in 2017 by Eggertspiel, and it was nominated for Kennerspiel in 2018.
A pithy name for a game, considering the subject matter.
Yeah.
So I'll give a short description of it. So in Heaven and Ale, each player manages the fields of a monastery and the monks that live and work there to produce the best beer. Players take turns paying money to plant resources on their grounds, which are wheat, hops, barley, wood, and water, pay money to recruit monks and harvest those resources, activate their monks and resources to collect money and points, and also claim objectives. Your beer is only as good as its lowest quality ingredient. At the end of a number of predetermined rounds, depending on the number of players, depending on where a player's brewmaster token ended on their scoring tracker, they may adjust their resources until their lowest value resource is as high as it can possibly be, then scoring a number of points based on its position on the tracker. After adding points from objectives to this total, the player with the most points wins. So it was a little confusing, I think, how I described it there. But essentially, what matters is where your brewmaster token is on a scoring tracker and where your lowest your lowest scoring resource is on your scoring tracker.
Right.
So of those five resources, they all have a token that goes on the tracker, your brewmaster goes on the tracker. It's all the same tracker. And depending on where the brewmaster is and the lowest scoring resource token is on that tracker, determines your final score for the end of the game, plus bonus points from completing objectives.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit more about the gameplay, because there's a pretty big mechanic in this game that I didn't mention. There's actually two big mechanics in this game that I didn't mention that we should go deeper into. So the first is how you take actions in this game.
Right, yeah.
So there's a board.
Like, yeah.
There's a board that sits in the center of the table. And it is it has a number of spaces looping around the edge. And each space is designated for either collecting and placing resources on your own player board, collecting and placing monks on your player board, scoring resources or monks, or sorry, not scoring, but activating resources or monks, and then completing objectives, which are called barrels in this game. So there's, let me count real quick, 5, 10, 15, 20, about, there's 25 spaces, about maybe 26. They're mostly resource spaces. There's 4 monk spaces. There are 6 score activation spaces and 2 barrel spaces. The rest are resources. So one player will go first, and then play goes clockwise from there. And when it's your turn, you can move your meeple to any space in front of it. So it starts at the end of the loop, so it can go to any space on the loop. Or sorry, it starts at the start, obviously. After it moves, it can only keep going forward. Also, it can only be placed on a space where you can do something. So if there's a resource tile on a space, you can go there in order to purchase that resource tile and place it on the board, but you have to have the money for it.
Right.
But if the resource tile is missing, you can't go to that space if the space is empty.
Right, and you can't land on a barrel space if you have no barrels you can score.
Right, if you haven't met any of the objectives to scoring barrels, then you can't go there either. So
exactly.
So you can go to any space as long as it's in front of you and you can do something there. So the first player will go, and then the next player will go, and so on. They go until they reach the end of the tracker. And then whenever you reach there, you get to choose one of four bonuses at the end of the tracker. But once a bonus has been taken by one player, another player cannot take it. And those bonuses are getting two gold, or ducats, as they are in this game, progressing one of your resource tokens forward two spaces, progressing your brewmaster forward one space, and being the first player to move on the next lap around the board. Now, you go around this board a number of laps, depending on the number of players, and this is how you determine how long the game goes. And in a four-player game, which is how we've played it so far, it goes around six times. And it's, I believe, less for less players. Okay. Right. So the second mechanic that we should talk about is your own player board, which has your scoring tracker on it, where you move your brewmaster and your resource tokens. But it also, more importantly, has your garden or your fields. So to describe the board, there are seven empty spaces, and then the spaces around them are the locations where you will place tiles. And the tiles are hexagonal shaped. So if you can kind of imagine it, there's like two rows of three spaces in the center of these blank spaces, and each one of these has a ring of hexagons around them. And then there's an extra empty space in the center towards the top. Right. Also, this your whole board is divided into two sides. So the left side of this board, the spaces are lighter. They're your sunlight side. And on the right side, the spaces are darker. They're your shadowy side. And then to quickly describe the tracker, it starts at,
I think,
at negative 10,
yeah,
sort of, in a way. But the first 10 spaces aren't numbered. The first 10 spaces are where all of your resource trackers tokens will start, except for your wood token, and as well as your brewmaster. Your brewmaster starts all the way at the end. And then going from there, there's the wheat tracker token, the water tracker token, the hops tracker token, and the barley tracker token. The final tracker token is the wood, which starts on one on the numbered portion. And that numbered portion goes up all the way to 20.
Right. And
so
then,
go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, and then this numbered portion is split into different sections with mm-hmm. three to four different spaces in each one.
Right. It's right. Split up into seven sections. The first two sections have four spaces in them, and then it's followed by three sections of three spaces, and then a section of two, and then the final section is just a single space. And these sections are important for determining how you move your pieces and score at the end of the game. These right. sections are where you want to move your brewmaster to,
right?
Which starts at the end of the tracker. There's one last piece that's important about this game, and that is the activation slots, I guess I'll call them. They go on the right of your player board, and there are 10 of them. There are one for every type of resource, which is, again, wood, barley, hops, water, and wheat. There is one for each type of monk, of which there are four. And then there is one space that is dedicated to a number variable, which we'll explain exactly how that works in a moment. So whenever you acquire a tile from the board, the main board in the center that gets filled up with tiles that you move your piece around to collect, you choose whether you want to place that tile on either the shadowy side or the light side. If it's on the shadowy side, you have to pay a cost for the tile equal to whatever numbers on the tile. Every tile will have a number between 1 to 5. If you put it on the light side, you have to pay double. And then later on, when you activate those tiles, if they're on the dark side, they give you money. If they're on the light side, they give you points equal to the number that's on that tile.
They move that tile's piece, or that resource's piece, forward that many spaces.
Right. When you gain points for a resource, yes, it moves along your tracker that many yes. spaces. If you acquire the monks, they, depending on where they are on the board, they cost a different amount. The first monk you encounter costs four, and then it goes down by one, so three, then two, then one, total of four monks on the board. They're the same thing, so you pay the cost that it shows on the board, and you pay double if you want to put it on the sunny side. And then the activation discs, these purple discs that you use to activate your resources in order to gain money or points or activate your monks, those don't cost anything. But when you collect one, you put it over one of those five activation slots on your player board, and each activation slot can only be activated once. So, Matthew, tell me about how activation works in this game.
Right. So basically, you put them on that space, and for, like Jeffrey said, for the pieces on the shadowy side, you get money based on their number. Pieces on the sunny side, you gain, you move their piece forward based on that number. Specifically, so if you activate one of the main resources, then you count all of the pieces of that resource you have on your player board and do that process where you gain money or points. Then if you activate a number, you instead choose a number because it has a little X on it, so 1 to 5, and then you get the points or the money for every piece you have of that number on your player board. So, like, if you chose 4 and you have a 4 of wheat on the sunny side and a 4 of wood on the shadowy side, you would score both, or you would activate both of those, get 4 points for wheat and then 4 money from the wood on the shadowy side. Now, The last one is monks, which are a bit more tricky. If you activate a monk, there are 4 different types of monk just based on the artwork. And when you activate one, that monk sort of activates all the pieces around it. So, like, it gets the money or points for the other pieces around it. But if there is a monk adjacent to another monk, you instead move your brewmaster up by 1 point when that second monk gets activated by the first monk.
Right.
Right.
There's one more thing
about
this board. I mentioned the empty spaces, which are surrounded by hexagons in this hexagonal grid. Whenever you fill up all the spaces surrounding one of these empty spaces, you get to place a shed. And when you do that, you have to examine what the total of the pieces surrounding the empty space is. So you look at all the numbers of all the pieces added up. And depending on that total, you'll place a different kind of shed there, which may or may not activate more pieces or move your brewmaster forward. Right. So the way that works is if the total of all the pieces surrounding an empty space is between 0 and 7, then you'll place a zero activation shed there. And it won't activate any of the tiles surrounding that space, but it will move your brewmaster forward 6 spaces on your tracker. If it's 8 to 11, it will activate 1 of the tiles surrounding the space, and it will move your brewmaster forward 3 spaces. If the total is 12 to 17, it will activate 2 tiles surrounding that space, but they have to be opposite each other surrounding that tile. And then you will move your brewmaster 1 space forward. 18 to 23, you will activate 3 spaces surrounding that empty space, and those have to be 1 space apart each, and it'll move your brewmaster forward 1 space. And if your total is 24 or higher, then it will activate 4 spaces, or 4 tiles surrounding that space. Any 4 you want, no particular rules for arrangement, but your brewmaster does not move in this case.
Right.
And activation works the same as if you had collected those purple discs from the board and placed them on one of those slots. But just for a single individual tile. If you choose a tile on the shady side, you get money. If you choose a tile on the sunny side, you get to move that tile's token forward, and if you choose a monk, then that monk will then activate the tiles around it.
Right. There is one more thing that happens that I forgot to mention when you place a purple disc to activate, which is that each of these activations is split into pairs on the side of your board. So, like, the X and the wood are a pair, and the rest of the resources are split into pairs, and the monks are split into pairs. And when you fill in both of these pairs, so you activate the 2 resources in a pair of these resources, you get to place use or activate a card that you start the game with. And these cards, you start with, I believe, 5?
Yes, they're called privilege cards, and you start with five of them.
Right.
They have a number of effects that will essentially either move tokens forward on your tracker or give you money or give you bonus points from barrels.
Right. And you can discard these cards at any point during the game to get three money or three ducats. Mm-hmm. Right. But if you save them until you activate, then they usually give you a large boost.
Right. So that's every part of the game. So let's talk about strategy.
Okay, yeah.
First of all, so I have a little like cheat sheet for your first go around the board.
First lap.
For your first lap, but it was on my phone. And where did I put my phone?
Well, I was going to say, I think I have one thing in mind, which is get at least one activation round one.
Yes, okay, so here it is. So yes, that's sort of at the end of my cheat sheet for the first round one. Okay, so on your first go around, you want to get at least one monk and/or 2 to 3 matching resources. And the matching is either the number on the resource or the type of resource, but you want to get like 2 or 3. 3 is ideal, but 2 is probably the more realistic one, along with one monk. And then you want to score for money at the end of the round or before the end of the lap. So that means that if you got multiple tiles of a similar number, then pick up one of those purple discs and score that number, and be sure to place those tiles on the shady side.
Right.
So the reason why you want to do this, and you want to get a monk and possibly score that monk instead, and the reason why you want to do this is the way that you get ahead in this game is by gaining extra value from your tiles. Because if you're simply placing them and then activating them through one of the 10 activation methods, then you're only using them once. But you have the potential to use a single tile multiple times, 3, 4, maybe even 5 times in some rare cases. And it's important also to have a solid economy at the start of the game.
Right. Money can be very tight early on.
Yeah, yeah. You start with like 25 ducats, I believe, but those are spent pretty quickly because you're paying sometimes double the cost for tiles to put them on the sunny side, regular costs for shadowy side. But you want to spend a lot of money right away so that you can start to build out your board. But you want to get an economy because later on you're going to have to start putting stuff on the sunny side and it gets very expensive. So getting an economy in this game means placing tiles on your shadowy side and then activating them multiple times by creating sheds, by making monks activate them, and then by eventually also using the activation slots on the right side of the board and picking up those purple discs to do so.
Right. Now, that being said, we specifically say to get an activation round one because also the purple discs start to go very quickly during the mid to late game. And yeah, it is likely that if you don't pick one up during the first 2 rounds, maybe you won't be able to fill out more than 2 pairs on your board.
Right. So the purple discs, there's 6 of them on the board to be picked up and used. But the first 3 on the board have limited use. The first purple disc that you encounter on the board as you're going around it can only be used to activate the number space where you pick a number and activate all of the tiles of that number. The second purple disc can only be used to activate monks. And the third purple disc can only be used to activate one of your 5 types of resources. So really you more think of it like there's only 3 purple discs on the board, and in a 4-player game, there's a chance that you won't get to use one of them, or you're going to use a very suboptimal one at the beginning of the lap.
Exactly.
So you want to use those on like your first lap, basically every lap you want to try to use at least one of these, because you're going to find that you're not actually going to be able to use all of them. So waiting for the optimal moment will eventually actually just lead to missed chances.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And it should be worth noting from just like a sort of strategic logic standpoint, if you get multiple of the same resource on your shadowy side, it's less likely that you'll be able to buy more later on to put on your sunny side, which means that activating it early for money doesn't really lose you points.
Right.
And I also want to bring up that the cards are very valuable, as many as you can, like, obtain. So, like, getting the one that gives you 12 Ducats, for example, early on is really important, because, you know, it's 12 free Ducats.
Right, and it essentially frees up an activation that you can save till the end of the game when you need the points instead of the money. Also, the card that advances your Brewmaster 5 spaces is very important.
Right. We should mention that we mentioned sort of briefly how the Brewmaster does help your scoring at the end of the game. Mm-hmm. It's specifically that the higher it goes, the better the exchange rate from your highest resource to your lowest resources. So it can go from, like, you know, lower your highest one by 4 to move your lowest one up 1. Mm-hmm. To, like, 1-1 is the furthest it can go.
Right. So, yeah, wherever your Brewmaster is, at the end of the game, you look at that exchange rate and you can push back your highest scoring resource a number of spaces to advance your lowest scoring resource one space.
Right. And then...
So, yeah.
Oh.
And then it also, after you have done that and you've advanced your lowest cost piece as far as you can, where your Brewmaster is will determine what you multiply its position by in order to get your final score. So, for example, if you ended with your lowest cost resource at 6 and you are in the third bracket, that bracket will then multiply 6 by 4 to give you your final score. If you were a bracket below, then you would multiply 6 by 3.
Exactly, right. And because of this, your Brewmaster, I think, is the most important piece to move up.
Mm-hmm.
Because it, like, directly ties to points late game.
Right. I mean, where your Brewmaster is, like, a one space difference. I mean, in that example, it was like a 6-point difference.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, the exchange rate is the same between those two brackets that I described. It's both 3-1, but because it's on the 9th space instead of the 8th space on the tracker, then it gives you 6 extra points. And there's, like, nothing else in the game that'll give you a 6-point difference.
Right, yeah. So because of this, other than the advancing your Brewmaster 5 spaces card, I think as far as sheds go, you should try to build into one of the one space activation that moves your Brewmaster, three spaces.
Yeah.
And if you can, a 0 space activation, but I think getting at least one space activation is good.
Right. So we're starting to talk about mid-game strategy.
Oh, right,
we talked about the first lap, and the first lap you want to get at least one monk, a couple of matching resources, and you want to activate. And you want to put everything on your money side for this first lap just because you need that economy.
Right.
So as you're moving into the mid-game, some things that you should look out for. You should want to try to keep a good mix of like all the different kinds of resources, all the different kinds of monks if you can, but the monks are a little more scarce. You want to try to put at least one monk next to another monk.
Yeah, because this gives you Brewmaster spaces.
Right. When we last played, you and I and our parents, I did not put a monk next to another monk for the whole game. And I think that's what cost me the game, because I tried to just get the most value I could out of the monks and the placement of the tiles. But I ended up being short like 10 points, despite being kind of in the lead until that point.
Right.
You know, if you took out where my Brewmaster was out of the equation, then I would have probably won. But because yours was like a bracket or two ahead of mine, it really pushed you over. I think I even had more barrels than you, more of those objectives.
Yeah.
Which then gets into the second point, or another point that I'm making for the mid game, which is you want to start looking at which barrels you're going for.
Right. Yeah. It should be pretty easy to get at least 2 of them offhand. Mm-hmm. Like the Brewmaster to 0 space on your tracker.
Let's go over what all the barrels do in this game. So
right.
So let's see. There's so for each of these barrels, there's a large and a small barrel. And when you go to the barrel collection space on the board, you get to pick up as many of these as you possibly fit the criteria for. And the you pick up the large one first if it's there. If it's already been taken, you can take the small one. The large ones are worth 4 points at the end of the game. The small ones are worth 2. So it's important to be the first one there.
Yeah.
In getting these. So the barrel's goals are to have your brewmaster at least reach the number one spot on your tracker. There's also to have all 5 of your resources at least on or past the one spot on the tracker. There's having 6 tiles on your board with a 1 on them. It's having 6 tiles on your board with a 5 on them. There's having used a scoring disc on all 4 monks. There's having used a scoring disc on all 5 resources. There's having 3 sheds on your board that have the same value, the same type, or having 4 sheds of different types on your board. There's having at least 1 resource at the end of the tracker on the 20 spot. There's having played 3 privilege cards, which are those cards in your hand that you play when you make a pair. And then there's having all 15 of your light spaces occupied by tiles, or having all 15 of your dark spaces occupied by tiles. So there's 12 of these objectives. And yeah, by the mid game, you want to start looking at which ones you think you can feasibly do very quickly before the 4th or 5th turn.
Right.
And then also identifying what your opponents are doing so that you can either race them for the large barrel or avoid it so that you're more guaranteed a large barrel.
Right. Yeah. I also want to bring up that around the mid game, like I said, is when you should start looking at what sheds you want to build.
Mm-hmm.
I touched on this a little earlier with the fact that, like, you know, getting a one space activation is pretty good to move your brewmaster.
Yeah, that's the 8-11 shed.
It seems like it's most likely to get the 2 space activation.
Yeah, getting 12-17 is a pretty common thing by having just like one or two monks, and then a good array of both high and low cost resource tiles. You'll typically just end up in the 12-17 range by default. Right.
Or the 3 space activation, which is 18 to, I want to say, 23.
Yeah.
That's also fairly common. But with both of those, if you just got those two, you can't get the 4 different types of shed easily. So mm-hmm. I think you always want one shed to be either the highest or lowest it can be.
Right.
So that you can get that barrel and then also get the bonus from the shed, of course.
Right.
Which is so the best in either direction.
There's 2 shed spaces in the middle of the board, and that's usually where there's probably just going to be a 2 activation or 3 activation shed, maybe even a 4 activation, but probably just a 2 or a 3 activation.
Right.
So because that's where you start, and you don't you can't really be picky and choosy about what you put there at the beginning of the game. So I like to kind of designate a corner of the board where I'm going to put a bunch of cheap pieces, because that's going to be the easiest way to get those low cost, like 0-7 or 8-11 sheds on the board. It's just by saying, like, this corner, I'm just going to keep all the expensive stuff away from it, fill it up with 1 cost and 2 cost spaces, put a monk over there, which counts as 0 cost, for the purposes of determining this value. And then get those brewmaster moving sheds.
Right. I like to also designate the topmost shed as like one of my build around sheds.
Mm-hmm.
Either like have the topmost one be the high numbered, and then have like the bottom left in the sunny side be a low number, or the topmost be a low number and have the bottom right in the shadowy side the high number.
Right.
Because the top one shares the least spaces with any other sheds. Because the ones on the sides, on either side, still overlap with the 2 in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the one on the top really only overlaps 1 space with the 2 to either side of it, and then a few with the one below it. But so I feel like that's the easiest one to like sort of quarantine and sculpt the way you want it to be.
Right. But it is important to pay very close attention to these sheds and how they're being built, and to plan for it by placing your monks on opposite sides of the shed, because the most optimal thing to activate from a shed is a monk, which can then go on to activate like three or four other tiles.
Right.
So placing monks on opposite sides is a good thing, because if you end up with a two cost, which is most likely the case, you'll just activate both monks, which will in turn activate all the other tiles surrounding the thing. It's as if you had activated four tiles. Or once you see that it's probably more likely going to be a three, then not putting the monks opposite each other, but putting them a space apart from each other so that they can both be activated.
Right, yeah. Even then,
essentially chaining sheds into monks into resources is kind of the way to go with these things.
Right. That's like the combo you want to build for.
Yeah.
I was going to say, even then, putting three monks around one of the center sheds is still good, even if you don't think it's going to be a three, just because like those are very good monks to score that are central.
Right. To and a whole I bunch would of prefer stuff. That if you put three monks, actually, sorry, it's impossible to have three monks around a shed and get the three activation, because would leave three other spaces, and the most a piece can be is five, which is 15, which falls
you're
in
right,
12
you're
to
right,
17
you're right
opposite side. So
good catch.
So there we go. So forget putting your monks space apart and planning for three, because that's never going to happen. Always put them opposite each other or directly next to each other so that you can get your brewmaster moving.
There you go. Well, then okay, maybe we should say, if you put a monk next to another monk, make sure that it's touching, or that it's not touching a shed that already has a monk opposite, if that makes sense. Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
And I guess the last thing I'd say is, well, I was going to say to put your monk in a space where it can be activated by two different sheds, but that's pretty much every space on the board except the ones on the outside, the very far outside. So as long as you're putting your monk central, then you're going to be able to get some activation. So place your monks in the center of the board and then try and activate them as many times as you can.
I have one more piece of strategy as well.
Okay.
Which is, there are three resources I think are which most important as far as like pieces to get.
Okay.
I think those are wheat, water, and wood. The reason is because once a piece reaches the 20 space on your tracker, if you advance it any further, it'll just give you money. So wood
for every space that it tries to advance.
Right. So wood is the easiest to do this with because it starts the highest. So, like, if you got an early wood 5 or even wood 4, even wood 3 on your sunny side, then you would be able to reach that part early on, which is actually what I did to win. Mm-hmm. Part of my strategy was getting wood all the way maxed out and then using that to get a lot of money late game to buy whatever pieces I need to finish out my plans.
Mm-hmm.
And then water and wheat starts the furthest, and then water. So if you want to get those up to speed, you need to get some pretty good numbers for them, or get them early on to be able to move up. Yeah. All right.
Okay. So I guess let's go into the design of the game then.
Sure. Yeah.
So the first thing that I want to say about this game is that the way that the main board works, which is the method that you use to acquire pieces and activate your pieces, just is a great inherent balancing mechanic.
Right. It's I think we talked about, I actually don't think we've talked about Tokaido before. Mm-hmm. But it's similar in that game, and in both games it's great, like you said, because
well,
you have to
in
trade
this game
off.
It's better.
Oh yeah, in this game it's way better, because what you want is oftentimes way much of a tougher choice than getting the early pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Like skipping ahead in this game can mean foregoing a whole lot of pieces.
I mean I was in the head in the lead sort of for this game, and oftentimes the most optimal action for me was to skip like half the board.
Yeah.
Like I would often go all the way from the start to the two cost monk. I think I did that two turns in a row because I just didn't need really any of the resources, or I was more hard pressed to like get that specific kind of monk. Or to get like a specific scoring tracker, which is somewhere around halfway across the board. So, so what that means is that the person who goes first or the person who's in the lead, is going to have very specific things that they want that will cause them to jump very far ahead. And that leaves just everybody else, all of the pickings from behind it, which is actually very useful for them.
Especially because if the person in first is skipping ahead, that usually means that everybody else is going to get the 15 shady side pieces or 15 sunny side pieces barrels. So, like, the bonus points kind of automatically even out that way. And, I mean, they get more pieces to score more, which means they're more likely to get the other barrels. So, yeah, it's a pretty natural balancing mechanic.
Right. Plus, if you're just like skipping like purple piece to purple piece, that means that you're not getting as much value out of them because you don't have as many tokens on the board as other players. The other players are collecting more tokens and they're going to get more value out of their purple scoring discs later on in the game.
Right. Yeah. I kind of like this this like tortoise in the hare action selection mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
Just the fact that like you have to choose between maybe what you want and just getting more things, I think, is a solid choice that, you know, like we've said, already adds depth to the game. Yeah.
Now, I want to point out another thing, and that the placement of the things on the tracker relative to other places, other actions, is kind of important and relevant in the design of this game. So, for example, there's only one monk that you can acquire, and it's the most expensive monk that you can acquire before the scoring space where you can only specifically score monks. So that particular scoring space is in front of the other three monks that you can purchase.
Right. Yeah.
So either you get little value and you have to pay a premium, but you get to score early on, or you get more value, but it comes later. Also, the monk that costs one, which is arguably the best space in the game, just because monks are the ways that you get value multiple times out of a resource space, and only paying 2 gold to place a piece that valuable on your sunny side is a big deal. That space is after all of the purple scoring spaces on the board.
Right, yeah. It's like they knew the value that monks had, and so they went out of their way to make it so that like you can't use monks as easily to get like a round one or a round two jump start.
Right.
Which is very nice, yeah.
And also, if you want to go for the most valuable monk, you have to forego scoring any points.
Right. Yeah.
Or scoring any resource, rather.
Yeah,
because getting any money or any points.
Because you'll be spending so much money on the monk.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's about it for the layout of the board.
I want to say this is a weird case of a game where I did want to bring up that I'm pretty sure that the first barrel space is after only the first three purple discs.
Yeah.
And then the second one's after the other three purple discs, which means that there is sort of an incentive to build towards those early activation spaces, because it means you would get the barrels faster than everybody else does. I was going to say, this is an interesting case of a game where first player isn't really that desirable. It seems like, at least. Because the other three spaces when you take first player are all really valuable, especially brewmaster space, the resource space. Like, I think those were more contested than the first player space when we were playing.
Right. I mean, the brewmaster, if it only moves forward one space, that's the difference. You know, that could mean the difference between, like, that could be a 10-point difference. That could be any number of points, but usually somewhere between like 5 and 10 point difference.
Yeah.
And then moving a resource two spaces forward, that could be like a 3 or 4 point difference, depending on where your brewmaster ended up. And then 2 gold is important early on, just because money is pretty scarce in this game.
Yeah.
Unless you're managing your activations like perfectly. I want to say that what the first player means in this game also ties in with how the first three scoring spaces are very specific in what they can be used for. And that is that both of these mechanics together force you to think a lap in advance.
Yeah.
So you want to, I mean, obviously you want to have a plan for the long game, which is like collecting certain barrels and having all of your pieces advanced as far as you can and having your brewmaster in a good bracket. But as far as like the short game goes, this game forces you to think at least one lap ahead, because if you do, then you can set up a good activation for one of those three first activation spaces that have a limit to what they can be used to activate.
Yeah, exactly. It almost feels like they could have like added another half of a lap or half of the board just at the end, because it's almost like in that regard the first three activation spaces are just like an extension of the previous lap.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that the round ends and more resource pieces are added to the board means that, like we said, it's another catch-up mechanic that way. It doesn't feel like you're planning ahead as much because it's a circuitous board. Like, mm-hmm. The fact that it's a loop means that, like, visually, there's not much of a separation between one lap and the next, which right. I think is nice. It helps you, like, realize that that's an option by seeing right. them right near each other.
Yeah, if the board instead went from one end to another and then leapt all the way back, you wouldn't necessarily catch on to that.
Right. And
maybe that's something different about Tokaido in that it's a straight line. Now, I mean, I get why Tokaido did it because of the theme of the game, but it kind of helps to contextualize certain actions in the future.
Right, yeah. Speaking of board design as well, I mean, the barrels being in the center of the board, I think, makes sense, because even though, like, even with what I just said about it being a loop, it is still the fact that, like, you'll probably be looking at a corner of the board at a given time,
mm-hmm.
but the barrels being in the center means they are always in that field of view.
Right. You can compare it to game like Agricola, which puts their, what are they called? Those major constructions or something major like that? Major improvements. Those are on like a separate board off to the side. And, you know, depending on table space, it might be sitting like between two players. And then in that case, you're less conscious about that kind of thing. Right. So keeping them in the center, yeah, it's a good decision.
Right. Yeah.
I want to talk about the setup of this game. Because I think so the way that this game is designed to be set up, there is a number of tokens for all the different monks and resource tiles with all the different types and numbers on them. And they're split in two groupings. They have a group that has a Roman numeral 1 on the back and a group that has Roman numeral 2. And you're supposed to refill the board with all of the pieces with the 1 on the back first until they're all run out. And then start to use the 2. So in setup, you have to separate these things. And then in the upkeep in between rounds, when you're refilling the board, you just have to be sure you're pulling from the right pile.
Right.
I think this is the most tedious acceptable, the most acceptable level of tedium for setup that a game should allow in order to have this kind of pacing
right.
and distribution to it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I understand the balance reasons why it exists. And it's sort of like Pandemic in that regard, how it splits mm-hmm. up things into intentional groups based on the time of the game.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it is unfortunate that it does take some effort to do.
It's a little unfortunate, but I think in this game it's manageable. I think yeah. if it were any more tedious than that, then yeah. you'd start to push it.
I think the rest of the early game goes quick enough that you kind of just go right into it, mm-hmm. and that setup doesn't feel like it added that much more to the game.
Now, mentioning the early game, something interesting about this game is that on your first turn, that's when you have the most options in the game. As the game progresses, your choices become a little less, there's less options to the choices that you make.
Right. Either by
and your I don't know. Usually a game, I think that a game should start, maybe this is just a personal design philosophy, that a game should start simpler and then start to increase your options as you go, because you start to develop an understanding and you start to understand what your options actually mean.
Right. That's a much more natural thing. Yeah.
Right. This game, on your first turn, you have the most options ever. Like, you have enough money to buy anything on the board, and you can jump to any space and buy it. And when you buy a tile, you can put it anywhere on your board. Your board is wide open. It's kind of hard to know exactly what it means to put a piece in any given space on your board.
Yeah, I think the second half of that is more important for me than the first one. Mm-hmm. Like, when I've played this with new players, I think everybody just kind of goes for what's right in front of the start because it's right there. You know, you're kind of used to doing stuff like that. But as far as where to put it on your board, that can be pretty impactful later on in the game. And the fact that there's no way to move pieces once they're on the board means that these early game decisions can really come back to haunt you when you don't know what they meant.
Especially if you didn't know that you need to place things on the shadowy side and get a good money, a good economy set up early.
Yeah.
The most you can be set back in this game is if you buy an expensive piece on the first turn and put it on the sunny side.
Right, yeah.
Although, I mean, if you're a savvy game player, you know that typically you want to build an economy before you start investing in points. So, I mean, and this is sort of a game for more experienced players to begin with.
Right, yeah. Oh, but I was going to say, the fact that the darker side is cheaper means that you're more inclined to sort of naturally just put pieces there in the start.
That's true.
You know, it's like you pick up the four cost or the four numbered piece, and it's like, oh, I can either pay 8, which is like half of my money, or I can pay 4. I'll do that first, or that one that's cheaper. So mm-hmm. you're kind of nudged into building your economy already.
Mm-hmm. I think in that case, it then becomes a little frustrating when, I mean, maybe sometimes when it comes to the cheaper pieces, you're like, should I put this on the sunny side? Like, right. Doubling this isn't a big hit against my funds, but what actually makes you make that decision in this game?
This is more what I think my biggest knock against the game is that the Brewmaster movement and the sunny side are both kind of like hidden. Like, they're both extremely, extremely important, but it's less likely that you'll see how important they are until very late game when you can't do anything about it, if it's mm-hmm. your first time playing. And also, I want to bring up a point of, like, being able to see what people are doing as far as, like, who's in the lead, who's not. You're more likely to see people with... Like, you're more likely to actually notice people doing things if they have a high economy rather than a high points.
Mm-hmm.
Because high economy means they buy more pieces and they get more money from the banks around the table of, you know, just random money you have scattered around. But when somebody is scoring well, that's only on their board. You don't really see it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's pretty deceptive in that, like... It hides, it doesn't necessarily hide who's doing well, but it's kind of hides by omission. Like I said, it's more likely to make an impact if you're doing well with money, but that doesn't mean you're winning necessarily. And so mm-hmm. somebody with a bunch of stuff in the shadowy side and nothing in the sunny side is going to make more of an impact that way. And other people are going to react to that and think that's important, which still skips ahead on the actual scoring importance.
Speaking of things not being visible,
and
there not being a lot of movement in the game, it's very hard in this game to see what your investments are going to turn out in this game. Like, I think maybe the most frustrating part about playing this game as a novice or as somebody who's never played this game before is that it seems like nothing happens very early in the game. Especially because it seems like, I mean, from a glance, it would appear that the activation spaces where you get the purple discs and activate a thing are something that you should wait to do, because you can only do it once. And so, like, if you build like a little combo of white pieces, if you got a combo going, you kind of want to keep it going and build it up more, and then eventually pay it out. And so, since you're not activating pieces, then the only chance when you're going to earn money and activate pieces is when you finish sheds, which takes a while.
Yeah.
Like it'll probably take two or maybe even three turns to finish your first shed. And if you finish a shed early, it's because you use cheaper pieces. And that means that it's going to be less impactful. Like you're only going to activate one space. So it feels like the optimal way to play this game is not the intuitive way to play this game.
Right.
And if you're not doing that, then it feels like you're not doing anything.
Right. And not only does it feel bad when like you don't want to move, get the activation discs early, but like doing that and not having enough money means that you'd probably have to discard those cards earlier. And that can feel bad because the three Ducats run out very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And then you
they run out basically on your next move.
Yeah. And then you have less of a chance to advance your brewmaster or your resources. So it's like a series of newbie traps that all feed into another.
Also, if you do take the early activation, like we suggest, and then it just so happens that after a lap or two, like that activation could have been way better. You just kind of feel bad, even though it's just an inevitable part of this game that you're gonna choose to activate something, and then as the game progresses, inevitably every single thing will get better.
Yeah.
Like when we played, I activated barley very early, and then I activated on the first turn. I got a handful of gold, and then at the end of the game, I had more barley pieces than any other type of tile. I had more barley than any other type of tile, and so that felt bad. But that's just going to happen with every tile you activate right. early. It's just an unfortunate part of this game,
right? And there is something to be said about like a game with baked in replay value in that regard. Like I think we often talk about games in terms of a new player experience because sort of when you're designing a game, you want people to play your game more than once, mm-hmm. and making sure that first experience is good means they're more likely to come back. Of course, like you want your game to have some value to people who do decide to go back and see, like, you know, there's more to learn, more to offer. But like, I don't know, it's hard for me to like come up with a reasonable standpoint on this sort of idea.
I mean, I kind of like the idea that maybe there should be like an easy apparent strategy that functions.
Yeah.
And that feels good to do. But then there's these hidden depths of strategy that can take you to greater heights.
Right.
And this game is lacking that initial like good feeling, easy strategy.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I think like, yeah, that fact that like there's nothing really telegraphed to you early on can hurt. I think, like I said, also the fact that you can't really make up for your mistakes in terms of placement early on is a mm-hmm. huge issue in this game, which is all about placement.
Right. Although I will say that that you don't get set back so much. Like there's some games, if you make a mistake, that'll set you back like 3-4 turns. But in this game, you just kind of have to build around it. And it's sort of like a half setback, I guess. It's like you took a bad turn, but it's not going to take a number of turns to fix it. Like, or maybe it does, but those turns aren't also bad turns. Like they're just suboptimal. You're not being set back. You're just slowing down a little bit.
Yeah. Now that being said, I think like when you finally do get that like big combo turn where you activate like a shed, which then activates like two monks, mm-hmm. I think those do, like once you see that, you kind of have like an epiphany, like, oh, this might be what I should be doing. And that might make you want to play again.
Right. If you like a game like Scythe, where you take a bunch of small actions to get these very big payouts in the future, then this is a great game for you. Like this game is more than any other game one where you take these small actions, you plan and plot very early on, and then the payouts can be massive in this game.
Right. So we learned that Michael Kiesling also designed Azul.
Right.
And you can see a lot of the same sort of concepts underlying these games in that game as well, such as
right.
like these small actions that build up to a big combo. We mm-hmm. compared that game to, or at least I compared it to like Tetris almost, and this still sort of fits that, but I think Azul has the benefit that, like, everything scores points, even if it's all alone by itself in a corner.
Exactly. Whereas in this game, you have to, like, set things next to things, and then in a turn and a half, it'll actually start to earn you points and money.
Yeah, I think this is a case where the game has a target audience, and it works fine for that.
Yeah, I mean, it is a Kennerspiel-nominated game, not a Spiel-nominated game. This is for serious gamers only.
Exactly.
And if you're willing to trudge through a play session of this where you make multiple of these bad decisions at the beginning and then realize how things come together so that the next time around you can set yourself up for huge success, then this can be a very rewarding game to play.
Yeah, for sure.
I don't think I have anything else to say about this game's design.
That's good for me.
All right. So we mentioned that this guy also designed Azul, or one of the designers of this game also designed Azul. So I guess that's kind of a recommended game, although I'd play Azul first and then check out this game.
Yeah.
Because this is a slightly more advanced game if you don't consider yourself to be an experienced board gamer. But other than that, can you think of any other games that match this style?
Most tile placement games.
Yeah.
Like, they all kind of have this idea of, like, a combo sort of setup and resolution.
I mean, I'll throw out Agricola.
Sure.
Since we did an episode on it, it's you do have your own player board and you place tiles on it, but you also place other kinds of structures on it that essentially will take up a tile's worth of space. So yeah, I'd give that out. That one's a little more brutal, I guess, in that there's penalty points in that game, and are none in this game.
I would say Tigris and Euphrates.
Okay.
But also, of course, Between Two Castles of Mad King Ludwig.
Yeah.
Both very good games in a similar style of a slow payoff, but, you know, worthwhile payoff.
All right. So with that, that'll be the end of our episode on Heaven and Ale. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.
If you'd like to learn if you'd like to follow us and hear our thoughts and get updates when we post stuff and interface with us, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at BG Bros Cast. If you want to find our episodes, you can follow us on any podcasting platform. You can leave us comments there. We'd greatly like to hear your feedback. You can also go to our website, bgbcast.com, where we have all of our episode posted and tagged. We've done an episode on all of the games that we suggested at the end of this episode.
Oh, yeah, Tigers, that's true. Tigris and
Euphrates, Agricola, Azul. Between Two Castles. Yeah, we did episodes on all those. So if you're interested in those, you can go check them out. Just search through the tags for those episodes. And also on our website, you can find a link to our TeePublic store, which is teepublic.com/user/BGBcast. And it is there where you can buy our merch. Sorry, I think it's /BGBroscast. BGBcast. It is BGBcast. You can find our shirts with our cool, cool logo on it. You could buy that, rep our podcast. And that'll be it for the BG Bros plug. So, Matthew, let's hit him with some Matt plugs.
Hi. If you go to our website, you can also find some articles I've written and will write in the future. I write articles mainly about game design recently.
You did an article on Will Wright?
What? Anyways. I get it. Anyways, I talk about video games so far, but I'm going to start branching out eventually, quote unquote. And that's under our website, under our episodes and articles column. And you can also follow me on Twitch. I stream on twitch.tv/twack. That's twitch.tv/twak. Usually from about 10 or 11 a.m. Central Time to 2 or 3 p.m. Central Time. Subject to change based on, you know, the day. And I play a lot of competitive games and roguelites. I've been speedrunning a game called Hob, and I've been playing a lot of a fighting game called Rivals of Aether. You can also find a Discord server through there where you can chat with us. And that's about it.
All right. Thank you for listening to this episode on Heaven and Ale, and we will see you next week for another episode of Board Game Bros.
See ya.